So we're halfway through our beginner-friendly course, the foundation course. So we've kind of covered the big picture stuff of the three jewels of refuge, our approaches as students, how to care for the mind, and investigating rebirth. So were there any outstanding questions from last week on investigating rebirth? And so, which way did your investigations go? Like, what kind of things did you look up? Yeah, there was one that I heard about years ago, was an SBS documentary, and that was the one that did it for me, where they had a lady. They took her back to the little town, wherever it was in Wales or something, and she'd drawn a map of how the town was in her past life, and they got to the town, and it was all wrong. And so they were all super disappointed and everything, and they were staying at the hotel, the pub there. She was like, "But it's so familiar to me, but the whole map of everything just didn't match." And then they went down to the town hall records, and back a couple of hundred years ago, the streets had a different configuration, and that matched perfectly. And I'm like, okay. That's enough for me. That kind of, because, and also there was no money involved. There was no ulterior motive or anything like that. But that one seemed like, yep, that's probable. Oh, the Pascal's wager. You don't have to feel bad about being skeptical, and you don't have to make your decision now. Keep on investigating and let it happen naturally. Yeah, good, good. That's great. Excellent. So how we're going to continue on today then is we've talked a bit about rebirth. So what is it that's actually reborn? Because that's kind of the next logical question. From a Buddhist point of view, what gets reborn is this mind stream, the continuity of the mind. So we'll have a look what the nature of the mind is, the general characteristics. The Buddhist definition, which is very subtle, and it's quite tricky sometimes if we're not used to investigating things in this way, but it's a really good structure to kind of hold all of our investigations. And then, of course, we will revisit our natural potential, how we all have Buddha nature, because once we start to understand the nature of the mind, then we can see how our nature is not different from the Buddha's nature. So that's getting more into Buddhist mind science rather than kind of religion. It's one of these classes that you just come back to again and again. And actually, in Discovering Buddhism, the first unit is mind and its potential. And it is literally mind blowing, like everyone's mind is blown. And then you do all of the units in Discovering Buddhism takes between 2 and 3 years, and you come back and do unit one again, mind and its potential, and it starts making sense. Just because there's so many questions involved with it. So let's set our motivation. Adjusting our physical posture. Making sure your lower back is supported, your spine nice and straight, but your body's still relaxed. So, in particular, let your shoulders drop. Being comfortable on the chair. And we can still be aware of all the sounds around us, the sensations, but we can just leave them around us and just gently bring your focus to the breath, just the rising and falling of the breath. Have the head just tilted slightly forward, chin tucked in, tongue on the upper palate behind the top teeth. Relax all the muscles of the face, especially around the eyes. And And as you're focusing on the breath, try and follow the entire duration of each breath. So, all the way as you're breathing in, still holding your mind gently on the breath, with a slight pause, and then all the way as you're breathing out. Have about 80% of your focus on the duration of the breath, and the rest can just be vaguely aware of what's going on around us. And as our physical body is settled and our breathing is settled, then we can also settle our mind. And adjust our motivation for being here, our purpose. Bringing to mind whatever reason brought you here tonight. And then expanding our motivation so that everything that we ponder on, that we think about, that we question, can bring clarity to our mind, can be of benefit now and into the future. And through that clarity, may we be able to bring a sense of peace to our own mind and those everyone around us, and to be able to achieve the full potential that we have with this combination of body and mind for the utmost benefit of all living beings. So, with this motivation, take a nice deep breath in. And let's set the scene with something really big. So here's a question. What if we could find the root cause of all suffering? If we could find not just kind of like putting out fires, but actually be able to remove the fire altogether so we never had to put out any more fires, you know? So not just putting a band-aid on all of our sufferings and trying to deal with them one by one, but just cutting off the cause of suffering. And what if we could find the source of all happiness, which we've been looking for, not quite sure if we've found it, is this going to work or not? So if we want to find both of those things, the key is the mind. So if you wanted to ask, say, is there a creator in Buddhism? You'd say the creator is mind, no external creator. The creator is our own mind, no external God. It's our mind that makes our reality. And so then it's imperative that we understand how our mind works. So it's not just our conscious thoughts, it's really the entire experience down to very, very deep, subtle states of mind. Because we don't really appreciate the nature of our mind or understand the nature of our mind, we get a lot of things wrong. And so then we have a lot of problems and suffering arise. We have, because of all of our various assumptions, we have a mistaken view and relationship with the world and with people. So even if we have good intentions, it doesn't necessarily pan out. But we can start to do something about it. So when we talk about mind, it's a huge topic. Mostly it means consciousness or awareness, being aware. It also means our perceptions and experiences, what we perceive through our senses. And even that is different for everybody. We could all be in the same room, but what we perceive can be quite varied. It also encompasses our emotions, feelings, the heart. So when Tibetans talk about the mind, they always point here to the heart of the matter. This is brain, this is the seat of the body, this is the mind. It also means all of our thoughts, our intellect, our conceptions, so how we interpret things, what we think about things. So, for instance, with music, we might all perceive the same music, but how we feel about it's going to be quite varied. It goes deeper. Mind also encompasses instincts. Habits, really deep-seated habits that are automatic, that we have no control over. Fight and flight, all those kinds of things. And our memories, too. So when we say mind, it's the whole spectrum of all of this. So we can revisit the difference between body and mind. So, like we talked about last week, we just slightly touched on it. How a person is imputed to a body and mind. So when body and mind, hello, welcome, are together, that's what we say alive. That's a person or a being, living being. When body and mind separate, that's what death is. And so we have the two continuums, a continuum of the body, which is made of atoms, it's physical. So the basis of our body, the DNA, from our parents, it's a continuum of matter. It's also like we put food in, that's got all nutrients and chemicals and minerals and everything, and it gets metabolized by our system. So there is a, it's not that our body is static, is it? It's an ongoing kind of process. And it is relatively easy to study in our culture because we've got all of the equipment. It's a physical thing and we've been able to study it. When it comes to the mind, it's completely different. It's formless, has no form. It has, it's a continuum as well, but of mental moments, so a continuum of experience. And because it's not made of matter, we can't measure it. We can't cut it up. We can't dissect it. It doesn't have a shape or a color or a form or an age because it's not physical. But just because it's not physical doesn't mean that it's non-existent. So, for instance, the feeling of happiness and suffering also isn't a physical thing, it's a mental experience. The feeling, memory as well, it's not a physical thing, it's a mental experience. But just because, say, happiness or suffering isn't a physical thing doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And it's still very subjective even then, because if you go to the hospital and they say, how much does this hurt on a scale of 1 to 10? It's because the experience of pain is different from the physical sensation. And to this day, medical practitioners are still trying to grapple with this because you can say it's a 7 or it's a 10, and sometimes you're believed and other times you're not believed. Depends if you've got brown skin. If you've got brown skin and you say it's 10 out of 10, everyone just thinks you're exaggerating. There is no way that we can accurately say this is a level of pain. It's always going to be subjective because it's an experience and that's not a physical thing. It's based on a physical thing, but how much we actually suffer is a mental thing and it's subjective. So when we're trying to learn about memory or happiness, suffering, boredom, daydreaming. We can't use physical technology because it's a mental experience. But the technology that we use then has to be mental technology. So this is what Corey Jackson has talked a lot about in his classes. The technology that we use is things like logic, concentration, focus, discrimination, analysis. And we've got to get really good at wielding these tools. And so if we're not used to it, it's just like running with scissors. You can get into a bit of trouble or get really exhausted very quickly. So trying to differentiate between body and mind, we can think of it as like that we're not our brain, we're not our neuroses. Our brain, which is the body, the physical part, and our experience, they're connected, but they're not the same thing. So when we look at brain imaging and all of those kinds of things, that's evidence of experience, but that's not the experience. So we can measure the evidence of something, but it isn't the thing. So there, for instance, just as the footprints of a lion are evidence the lion has passed by, but the footprints are not the lion. So all of those things happening in our brain, synapses and things sparking off, that's like the footprints of the lion, but it's not the lion. So there's brain activity and that corresponds with our experience, our feelings, but it isn't the feelings. The feelings are a non-physical thing. So for that way, you can't say that the brain houses the mind because the mind isn't a thing. You can't find the mind somewhere inside the neuron. And so that's why I put up the picture of the violin, that you can't find the music inside the violin. If you're a little kitty, you might look inside. Where is it? Where is it? And in a way, when we're trying to find the mind inside the brain, that's what we're kind of trying to do, is find the music inside the violin, or find the radio show inside the radio. So that sets the scene. How are we going? I mean, the main point is that there's this differentiation that the physical and the mental, they are intimately connected, but not the same thing. So we can, the physical, what's happening physically is evidence that something's happening experientially. But we can use our mind to directly know the nature of our mind because that's the technology that we use. That is the skill of developing like concentration, which is the mindfulness and then vigilance. So it's similar to like when you're driving, you one part of you is driving
Yes.
and the other is making sure you're not falling asleep.
Yeah, that's it.
And there are two types of focus or concentration. Okay, so this just sums it up from His Holiness and Thupten Chodron, the foundation of Buddhist practice. While the brain is material in nature, the mind is not. The mind lacks shape and color and cannot be perceived by scientific instruments. Like other produced phenomena, the mind is impermanent in that it changes moment by moment, although it is eternal in that it has no end. When it is obscured by afflictions and other defilements, it is said to be the mind of a sentient being. And when all obscurations have been removed, it becomes the mind of a Buddha. So just as our body has many parts, arms, legs, internal organs, and diverse characteristics, hardness, fluidity, mobility, heat, and space, so too there are many types of mind, gross and subtle levels of mind, primary consciousness, and the mental factors that accompany them. Sense consciousnesses and mental consciousnesses. In the case of human beings, many of these types of mind depend on the body and brain, but some do not seem to do so. Our sense consciousnesses depend on the sense faculties, the nervous system and brain, as well as on an external object. So that's the first thing that when we come to the characteristics of mind is all these different layers. So layers like an onion. So when the top layer is manifest, the other ones are hidden. So most of the time we have what are co our coarse minds apparent. So we have all the information coming in from outside through our senses, and then the experience of that information, we interpret it and feel this way or that way about it. So for that kind of mind, it depends a lot on our senses. And so if we're colorblind, for instance, we're going to have different perceptions coming in. Animals have different coarse consciousnesses as well. They can see how many hundreds of kilometers away. So our sense perceptions depend on our sense organs. And our mental perceptions depend on our brain, but they're coarse minds. There's kind of the analogy that we can use. It's like a house with many windows. So looking through one window, it's like sounds, and another window, it's sight, and another window, it's tactile sensations. So each of our senses kind of captures one bit of that, but we don't see all the colors and we don't hear all the sounds. They're all parts of a frequency. We just have these sense organs that pick up a little bit of it. So the way that modern science explains that and the way that Buddhist mind science explains it is really similar with the sense consciousnesses. But below these coarse minds are more subtle states of mind that don't depend on these sense organs. So they're non-conceptual minds. They don't depend on culture or on what kind of brain that we have. And so those more subtle minds are there, but they're not manifest, they're latent. And a little bit they come up when we go to sleep, a more subtle mind comes up. When we go through the death process or when we're, say, in a coma, then the coarse minds are pretty much dormant and the more subtle minds are there. So we can tell it's a more subtle mind because if you go to sleep and you dream about running, you're not actually running. It's a sleep disturbance when you get up and you sleepwalk because the coarse minds don't rest. So the very subtle mind that is that pure nature, just like the Buddha's, it's there, but it's all down under through those layers of the onion. It's not manifest, so we don't even know it's there. Great meditators, of course, can quieten all of the distractions that come in through the senses so that that subtle mind can come up, can be manifest. The other thing, of course, that we've been saying a lot about is this continuum, a continuum of awareness that's constantly changing. So just like a river. It's, a river is there, but you can't pick up a bit and go, this is it. And so that's why we say the mind is impermanent because it's changing. It's not a solid, fixed one thing. And what's really nice about this is that it shows also how our mind, each mind is individual. So just like all rivers, they're made of water. So in that way, they're the same nature, but it doesn't mean they're the same river. Brisbane River and Melbourne, the Yarra River, they're different rivers. So all of our minds are the same nature, but it doesn't mean they're the same mind. So many times I've heard people talk about all of this here, and then it all gets too much, and we just all fall in a heap, kind of, and go, oh yeah, well, one is all and all is one. And our minds turn to mush. And it's kind of tempting to kind of do that, but this is it's more nuanced than that, of really recognizing our nature, but how each mind is an individual continuum. And actually all the Buddhas too, all the Buddhas, the same nature, enlightened, but they're all individual Buddhas as well. So sometimes our mind is a raging torrent. of all the experiences in that river, negativities and confusions and toxic emotions. And other times our mind is a nice, calm, steady, strong current. There's a lot of stuff that goes in, that contaminates that clean, clear water. We can also say that the mind is beginningless, which means that a beginning cannot be found. If we look for a beginning, we will just keep on looking for a beginning, just like a number line. If you try and find the end of the number line, that's it. You just keep on going. So this someone actually in the time of the Buddha asked the Buddha, so when did time begin, or when did the mind begin? And the Buddha said, actually, we cannot find when the mind started, and also we can't find when time started, because it's kind of the wrong question. And that's one of the questions I'm not even going to talk about. So even the Buddha kind of drew the line. And I've heard lots of scientists say that actually the question isn't about not when did the world start or when did time start, but actually time started when the world did. Time started with the world, with beings. It's not like there's time and then the world began. It's like the world is experienced. So time started with experience.
So Georgie wants to know, when we're unconscious, does Buddhism say that those subtle parts of the mind rather than thoughts are active, even though we're not awake?
Yes, yeah, so when we're unconscious, it kind of depends, because our coarse consciousness isn't necessarily, well, not definitely. Sometimes our coarse consciousness is not functioning, but sometimes it is functioning, but we cannot respond. So many people report being in a coma, and also with Lyme's disease, this happened with Anthony Hopkins, that he could hear everything, and people were talking about how he's just a vegetable, and he wasn't, but he couldn't communicate or indicate in any way that he was conscious or there for months and months. So that's one thing. But another thing, you can be in a really deep coma where there's nothing coming in through the senses, and there's no mental activity. So it is just like blackness, but there's still a continuum. So that's like a river going underwater, underground. It's an underground river. It still goes. It's just not manifest. And so after that karma is finished, then the consciousness comes back up again, either in that life or in a new life. But the fact that we can be in a coma or even just asleep and wake up again shows that there's continuity there. Also, our mind is accompanied by mental factors. And so these mental factors are like we have the driver of the mind, and the car, sorry, is like the mind, and the mental factors are like the driver. Now, I love this analogy, because mostly we're drunk drivers, aren't we? Which mental factors are driving our mind? It's not always clarity, is it? And we're really directed by whatever various afflictive emotions and distractions are going on. And just as it is really dangerous to have all the kids in the car yelling and screaming and doing whatever while you're driving at a million miles down the highway, that's how we live our life. So when you think about it, actually, the amount of violence or accidents, it should be a lot more. Considering what everybody's going through behind scenes. So these mental factors, they flavor the mind like salt flavors water. You think it's inextricable. It's completely one with the water, but that water can be purified. So again, our disturbing emotions, they may feel like they are completely part of us and part of our nature. they can be purified from the mind. And that's really where Buddhism differs from Western psychology. Western psychology just takes the salt water and tells you how to live with salt water. But because it doesn't have, there isn't any kind of unified theory of mind from our Western tradition. You can ask any scientist or any psychologist or social worker or whatever, and everybody has a different idea of what the mind is. There's no unified kind of thing. So to even think that it's possible to purify the mind, like that's a question way too far on. So before we do a reflection, how are we going with this? The general characteristics, is it taking shape? It's a wave.
That's doing.
Yes, the
Yeah.
wave and particle theory.
Yeah.
Yes, and it depends on an observer.
Yeah. So I was
It does relate, but probably not in that area.
like.
But that whole thing, that experiment of the wave, is it a wave or a particle? And it depends on if it's being observed or not. It's not to do with the brain, it's to do with, and this is why it's such a sticking point in Western science, because what that proves is there is no objective reality. And yet, Western science is based on an objective reality. So they've just disproved their own premise. But from a Buddhist point of view, it just proves dependent arising, that you can never have a thing out there without an observer, an experiencer, because the thing is the experiencer. What sense faculties that we have depends how we experience an object. We actually make that object. So, you know, we think there is a sound out there. Cars, we can hear the sound. That sound is not out there. That sound is all the little hairs in our eardrum being tickled and the fact that we have an ear. So we've made that sound, and yet we think it's out there. So all of Western science is pretty much based on the thing out there, and where an objective, separate part that is observing it. And then, kind of as science progressed, I think pop science, we're all stuck in like 80 years ago, started to go, well, actually, no, depending on who the observer is, the object changes. And that's actually getting closer to reality. That's what in Buddhism is called dependent arising. And yeah, just keep reading those experiments and thinking about it, because the implications of it, then that's where Buddhism and Western science start dovetailing. When it comes to perceptions, and people, we often say, oh, seeing is believing. Well, that's just like a shorthand so that we get through life. But when we start investigating, it's actually incorrect, because what we see, how we experience things, that's not how it is at all. But if we were the whole time in the wave and particle theory kind of state of mind, we wouldn't be able to make a cup of coffee. The whole thing is to be able to develop our wisdom enough that we can remember the interdependence of the wave and particle theory whilst making the cup of coffee. And then when everything changes, we're not going to be distressed. Right, let's do a reflection. Okay, begin by letting your body settle and your breathing settle into a natural rhythm, rising and falling. Feel your mind as a wide open sky, clearing after a passing storm. And set an altruistic motivation that the clarity we cultivate may support our own well-being and the well-being of others. Recognizing even just a few minutes of practice can bring clarity and ease. So recognize that your mind's natural state is spacious and unbroken. even when confusion seems overwhelming. The nature of the mind is like a clear sky, and afflictive emotions are like passing clouds or temporary pollution. And when you stop feeding in negativity, the mind can return to its natural state. So what happens when you observe your thoughts without identifying with them? Notice that they lose some power, like clouds dissolving in sunlight. And how does awareness feel when you let emotions arise and then pass? Awareness emerges naturally, like the sky revealed when clouds drift on. And how does it feel when you rest in awareness rather than the stories around it? It feels spacious, like the clear sky holding every cloud without strain. So gently shift your focus from the individual clouds or thoughts or feelings to the spaciousness, the awareness in which they arise. Feel the openness around each breath. Allow each thought to arise and fade, and rest in the spaciousness that remains. And then carry this sense of skylight clarity as you open your eyes and bring your focus back to the room. So this is from Lama Yeshe, Introduction to Tantra, about this meditation. Why is it so important to contemplate the clarity of our consciousness in this way? It's because, as we've seen again and again, the source of all of our happiness and suffering, the root of both the pains of samsara and the bliss of nirvana, is the mind. And within the mind is our habitual wrong view, our ignorant, insecure ego grasping that holds onto the hallucination of concrete self-existence as if it were reality. The way to break the spell of this hallucination is to see the illusory nature of things and recognize that all phenomena are nothing but fleeting appearances arising in the clear space of our mind. Thus, the more we contemplate the clarity of our own consciousness, the less we hold on to any appearance as being concrete and real, and the less we suffer. Okay, so let's have now the definition of mind. And it's really nice. The definition of mind: mind is merely clear and knowing. That's it. Mind merely gives rise to something and then engages it in a cognitive manner. So that's slightly more technical sounding from Thupten Chodron. Buddhism mind is defined as mere clarity and awareness, or clear and knowing. It is clear in the sense that it reflects or illuminates objects. Objects, red roses, sweet fragrances, sounds, and ideas can all arise in the mind. The mind is aware in that it perceives or is involved with these objects. It knows or is aware of the world around and inside of us. And the mind is the mere function of clarity and awareness, that which allows for the arisal of objects and is involved with them. The other thing is that it's not just a blank kind of flatlining, but it's the mind is naturally blissful because it's clear of all the inner toxicity. So this is the fundamental nature of the mind, clear and knowing. And, you know, we might kind of ask, well, why, if that is the case, am I so confused and tired all the time? And it's because it's not just that clarity and awareness, but there's all of the other rubbish and habitual things and post-traumatic stress and all of the detritus of our life is accumulated in there. But the nature of the mind, naturally blissful, clear, and if we can remove all of those inner toxins and develop all of our qualities, that's actually what Buddhahood is. And at present, our mind is obscured by delusion and ignorance, like clouds obscuring the sky. So the kind of ignorance, it's not just ordinary ignorance, but it's really being unaware of our nature. And I've often wondered why. Why is this such a problem? It's because we're constantly, our focus is constantly drawn outwards by our senses. We're constantly distracted by everything that's coming in from our senses, that it's really difficult to become aware of our nature. We get inklings of it, but how often do we even make space for that? The first step is to stop responding to them or being reactive.
Yep.
So to stop making them worse.
Yeah.
So if we want everything to settle, it's like we stop agitating everything for starters. And then, yes, they can all be removed, but we've got to stop pumping new ones in. So that's why just calming down isn't enough, because we can become calm and we get a moment of respite. But that's like just the beginning part, because then what do? The very next moment, we just be reactive again, or we pump in more mistaken views, afflictive states of mind, distorted perceptions, pump it all back in again. So it's like purifying the water and then putting more toxins in. Yeah, we have to.
Experience and
so you go, yes, that's there, and I don't have to give it any attention or reactivity. So we stop pushing against it, which really concretizes it. And so that stops making things worse. But then we turn our mind to what is there and who is observing it. And that's not what it first appears like in the beginning. So then we change and what's there changes. And so that's when the mind becomes more stable and more calm, regardless of what's going on around us. But it's even, we don't even stop there, because then that duality of me here and that there, that also stops. So it's the dualistic mind that brings a lot of the suffering. I mean, we experience the worst of it, where we have the us and them and all of the fear and aggression that comes from that. But it goes down very, very subtle, right to our instincts. Ignorance is the opposite. Yeah, that's right. And there's all different types of ignorance. So we're not really talking about ignorant as in I can't speak French.
Yeah.
It's ignorance of our nature and of how we believing appearances.
Yeah.
So let's have a look at the clarity. So the clarity, because the mind is clear, it can give rise to something. Because the mind's clear, all experiences can arise with it. And I mean, having the mirror as an example is great because the mirror can reflect an infinite amount of objects. It's not like one day the mirror goes, I'm full, that's it. It's like it will never be full because it's nature's clarity. All the experiences can arise within it. The clarity, so it's not a conscious act of will and it's not a passive act. So it's this very fine middle way. So it's not that the mind conjures something out of nothing, causes something to arise. That's too far one way. And it's not that something just arises in the mind all by itself either. That's too far the other way. And when we say that objects arise within the mind, that they can arise in a distorted way or a clear way. So it can be, they can arise directly, what we have through our senses or our thoughts. We can be aware of a thought or a feeling arising, but also objects can arise indirectly. When we're in deep sleep, they can appear clearly or they can appear in a confused and deluded way, but we're still engaging with them. So that's the clarity part, and that's to do with what we call the nature of our mind. Its nature is clarity. The next part is the knowing, which is the function of the mind. Cognitive engagement, to know something or be aware of something. And we relate to an object and we're aware of it in some way, whether we're aware of it in a distorted way or not, but we're engaging with it. So again, it doesn't mean that we're not necessarily conscious of it. When we don't necessarily have an emotional bond with whatever objects and we don't necessarily understand them either. We're just engaging in some way. A lot of it's through habit. You know, when people come in and you go, hi, how are you, la, 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 and sometimes the interchange goes, hi, how are you, good, thanks, before anyone's even said anything. Yes. So there's something happening there. We're not necessarily conscious of what's happening. We're skipping over all sorts of bits, aren't we? But there's still an interaction happening there. So moment by moment, there's an arising of a sight and then seeing it, or an arising of a feeling and then feeling it. So the arising and the feeling of it, the arising and the seeing of it happens simultaneously, and it happens moment by moment. So this is why we'd say, because this component of the definition, that with mirrors, and say computers, there's the clarity, but there's no sentience, there's no knowing. So even with AI, it looks like there's knowing, but it's not, it's just an appearance. There's no sentience or awareness from the side of AI. And like we were talking about last week, you know, all the really great fantasy and sci-fi movies will say, well, what if the mirror was conscious? So the thinking part is the conceptual mind. So what we have is our senses make contact, and then a feeling arises, and then on top of that we layer whether we like it or dislike it, or whether it's good or bad. But the actual function of the cognitive engagement of the mind, it happens simultaneously. An experience and the knowing of it happens simultaneously, moment by moment. I'm not sure if that answers the question, Ashley.
Yes.
Okay. So we've got clear and knowing. So when we're getting this definition, we're building a definition here. So a definition is they've got to be economical, isn't it? So it's the absolute bare bones of what something is. And so there's a third part of this definition, which is the word merely. One little word, merely clear and knowing. So this gives us the parameters of what the mind is. So it's not more than being clear and knowing, and it's not less than being clear and knowing. So it's the mere continuity of this clarity and experience of knowing. So that means that there's no extra in there. No extra soul or entity on one hand, and it also means that it doesn't go too far on the other hand and you become inanimate. It's right in the middle there. So there is a continuum, but there's nothing more than a continuum of body and mind. So this is what Lama Tsongkhapa, who the image up there, not to refute too much and not to refute too little. So, and part of the whole project of Buddhism is to be able to free ourselves from this feeling that we are a body and a mind and a me. So that's an appearance, a feeling that we experience at first, but it's not necessarily tied to reality. And actually, when we experience that of the me, all the problems stem from this grasping at a me. So that's why when we're looking at the nature of the mind, it's the mere clarity and awareness. There's not an extra soul or a me or anything. And it really frees us up then, because if we recognize, really, on an experiential level, if we think of this, we recognize the nature of our own mind, and then we think, well, everybody else, that's their nature too. So we're fundamentally the same. That same clear nature, the ability to know, to have experiences. So that is the most fundamental solid basis for respecting all life, right there. It's a scientific basis for respecting life. So the nature of mind. Well, we might easily say the words, the mind is mere clarity and cognitions. It's difficult to actually have a notion of what the mind is, let alone to perceive its clear and cognizant nature. Although the clarity and cognizance of the mind are present in every moment of mental activity, we are not aware of them. What prevents this? A consciousness is usually identified in relation to its object. The visual consciousness perceiving blue, or the mental consciousness thinking about a table. When a consciousness engages with its object, it appears in the aspect of that object. Because of the mind's involvement with that object, it's obscured from perceiving the actual nature of the mind. The mind is usually invaded by a host of constructive and destructive thoughts that concern external objects and people we have perceived or experienced. These cloud the clear and cognizant nature of the mind, preventing us from perceiving it. So that's just like, you know, when you're looking at the sky and the clouds, and you focus on the clouds, it's really hard to focus on the space. So when the flow of thoughts slows down, it is possible to see into the depths of the mind, its clear and cognizant nature that is like a still pool of water.
Is it the subtle mind/mind continuum that allows for remembering a past life? Is it the link?
Yes, so it comes from the subtle mind, because it can't be born on the brain, because of course the brain comes into existence with this life. So not the very subtle mind, but the subtle mind. Yep, that's right. Because what else is a memory carried on but the continuity of the mind? And it can't be the coarse minds that are dependent on this body or on the previous life body, because that's, you know, done and dusted. So for that, then it's it's like the mind stream and everything that comes along with it that is non-physical. And so that's actually what we'll end up talking about next week, which is karma, which is everything that is in that mind stream that comes from life to life, that haunts us or that blesses us in this life. Because where do we get our personality from? Yeah, so a lot of, so here we have mind merely gives rise to something and then engages it in a cognitive manner. So the word merely. Tsongkhapa said not to refute too much or too little. And so when we're talking about a definition, this is the bare minimum for an experience to occur. We're not adding anything on, even though it might be tempting to. So without anything adding on soul or entity, and without being the other side of material reductionism, becoming inanimate, being nihilistic. So, I mean, many times we just yo-yo between extremes. We go from say, being an essentialist, I suppose, thinking that there is an essence separate from this continuum of mind. Or I think, like in the Hindu tradition, you have this idea of an Atman, an entity or a soul. So that's kind of on the essentialist side of things, thinking of essence. On the other side of things, in the West, we've kind of got nihilism or materialism. We've got a whole list here. So, okay, on this side, we've got the essentialist. So we have religion, an external creator. Instead of mind being the creator, an external God. Substantialists, that there's a substance or an essence as well as body and mind. Spiritualists, so that's like not organized religion, but still some kind of idea of a third thing. I'm not sure, I don't know much about paganism, but that's, you know, it's nice and decentralized and nature-based. But I'm not sure if there's this idea of a soul or if you're one with nature. And the Atman, on the other side, you've got the nihilist, you've got scientific materialism, which is that whole idea that there is an objective truth, which then science went on to prove that there's not, and then had a mental breakdown. I mean, a lot of that just comes from just the arrogance of being an imperialist culture. We've got material reductionism, which is this one of that we're nothing more, that the mind is nothing more than a product of the brain, an emergent property of the brain, as if something non-physical can come from something physical. We've got existential determinists, which is neurology is destiny. Whatever our brain is, we're doomed. We're doomed to our neurology, where everything is medicalized. And that's pretty much nowadays pop culture. We've got the whole thing of thinking that who we are is just our body. And my favorite example of that is if you've ever watched Botched, people really think they are their body. You had the Dadaists that said, you know, this in the Great Wars, all those humans are dead, God is absurd, and then they turned it around and went, God is dead, humans are absurd. But actually, we don't have to yo-yo between any of these. We can just think, who am I really? Is this just mere continuity of experience? Of clarity, by nature clear. And that nature, no different from the Buddha's nature. So before we do a meditation, how are you going with the word merely? So what do you reckon? How does this sit with how you've been thinking and feeling over all the years? Yeah. So I think, to, again, take it really nice and slowly. So we have this this kind of feeling of like there's a soul separate from the mind. Yeah, there's something or other going on. And so it is like shifting a perspective, because there is Jane, is it? Yeah. So there is Jane, right? But so we kind of, or, you know, Miffy, we kind of think that's the real me, whereas actually that's like if we're looking at, say, a river, you know, the beginning of the river might be Tarragindi Creek, and that's what it's called then. And then it goes in and it joins, and then now it's called Brisbane River. So that's kind of like, you know, at the beginning it might have been wherever I was, Bernadette, and then next life, now Miffy. And because I'm Miffy, I think I'm the real Miffy. I think I was Miffy back then and I'm going to be Miffy next. So there is a Miffy there and there is a Jane there, but how we interpret it, we can kind of swivel it all the way around. And there's a huge benefit to be able to understand it in this way, because it stops that clinging and fear. What's going to happen to Miffy? You know, well, Miffy will be finished. It's no problem. The continuity, that moment by moment experience, it goes on to the next.
So is there a finite number of minds? If we're all individual minds, not part of,
yes. Is there a finite number of minds? Good question. Yes, so the answer is yes, but they're countless. There's so many you can't count them. Yep. It's an interesting answer. That's right, the population explodes, but also species go extinct. So whether there is a balance of X amount of life forms on the planet, well, we can't even count the amount of life forms on this planet. You know, they do that calculation about there's still how many species to be discovered. Well, how do they even know that? But that's what they say. They've read that 60% of species have yet to be discovered. So that's countless. Yeah. So it's good to have these questions of that thought of, you know, who is this Miffy or this Jane? It's just this portion of the continuum. And it'll change, and it has changed. And so rather than getting so tight that we get to ourselves, the me, focusing on that nature, like the river, that clear water, then wherever you come across clear water or rivers, you have respect for it. You recognize it. The karma ties in what's in that river. What comes downstream from your past life to now for us to grapple with great surprise and shock. Yes, there are pleasant things on balance, yeah. Okay, let's do another reflection. So settling your body, letting your breath come naturally, and allowing your awareness to become still like a reflective surface. Setting an altruistic intention, wishing that whatever clarity we gain may benefit not just ourselves, but everyone whose life we touch. And remembering that the clearer your mind becomes, the easier it is to understand yourself and to reduce unnecessary struggle with yourself and others. Our minds often reflect experience in distorted ways when we are clouded by emotion. And we mistake these distortions for reality itself, reacting to shadows. Like a mirror covered in dirt, the mind can feel contaminated. Yet its natural clarity is never lost. So, what is the state of your mirror mind today? If it feels clouded with confusion, this dirt can be cleaned, even if at first it looks messier, like wiping a long neglected surface. And how do craving and attachment stretch your reflections out of shape? Wanting pulls images into exaggeration, much like a funhouse mirror. Elongates a simple form. We just need to think of some toy that we wanted when we were little that was so all-encompassing and now means nothing. And in what ways does anger twist the person we see? Hatred makes reflections appear grotesque and fearful. And if we believe this distortion, we may end up shooting up the funhouse arcade. So rather than focus on the contents, become aware of the clarity, your nature, in which all shapes and figures can arise. And that trust that as your mirror-like mind is cleaned with the power of purification, you will begin to perceive clearly and naturally respond to life in the best way. We can begin to mirror each person's potential rather than their faults or impurities. So to end this reflection, set your mind in a determination that day to day to notice that people are not their faults, but their luminous, clear nature. Okay. So this takes us back to Buddha nature. So we did touch on this at the very first class, you might remember. What is Buddha nature? It is the pure, clear light nature of the mind. So it's not some abracadabra magic thing. It's actually our nature. The Buddha's term for it is the Dharmakaya, the truth body of a Buddha, its empty nature. And probably if we were trying to find a parallel between, say, theistic religions, Dharmakaya and God, you might find a parallel there. But because there's no unified definition of God either, then it's really tricky. So probably all the definitions of God are more tending towards, say, Yahweh, you know, the inexpressible is more parallel to the Dharmakaya, the truth body, the truth nature of the mind, the truth body of a Buddha. It's empty nature, it's clarity and purity. And so because of this nature, nothing can stain this nature. Just like nothing can harm the sky, it doesn't change the fundamental spaciousness of the sky, we can remove the pollution. So with our acorn, the fundamental property of the acorn is to become an oak tree, and the fundamental property of our mind is to become a Buddha. And this is really mind-blowing. Like, what do we want to be when we grow up? Is become a Buddha. Because that's fundamentally our nature. And actually, it's the nature of all living beings. But when you have a different combination of body and mind, it is far more difficult to connect with that nature. If you've got any form of pet, you know that they can have really amazing concentration, but what they're preoccupied with is incredibly limited. And they've got no interest in the things that we have interest in. But the nature of your pet's minds is the same. It's the same nature as the Buddha's and the same nature as yours. But this combination of body and mind, as a human being, it's the optimal way to be able to actually become aware of our nature, of our potential to become a Buddha. And as being a human being with this potential and then being able to recognize it, it kind of implies some form of universal responsibility as well. You know, that if we have this potential, we have to bring it to the fore, and we have to help other beings be free of their limitations and suffering. So if we recognize all beings have this potential, that becomes the basis of respect for ourselves and for others. Then our respect for others isn't based on what they've done or haven't done. It's not whether we feel affectionate towards them or not. It's just actually based on their nature and their potential. And so that means you can think, you can start with the ones closest to you, the pets that you love, the people in your family, they all have Buddha nature. So if you've got, say, relatives that are undergoing a form of addiction, it's really easy to fall into the trap and think, oh, my brother who is an alcoholic or something. And so you start identifying with their problem. So Venerable Rabina pointed out years ago, it was just so incredibly helpful to me to say, my brother, who is a potential Buddha, is undergoing addiction. So now suddenly, now I'm thinking my brother who has this potential, who's got also this incredibly overwhelming problem, but he's not his problem. So you start with those that you love and you can see it. Then you can start then go on with strangers. And then I think of people like Putin or Trump. And so my visceral reaction is what it is. And then I think they too have Buddha nature. So now how can you hate someone like that? So all of my agitation and aggression and reactivity, it just melts away. And not only that, but actually it makes me want to cry for them because they have Buddha nature, and what are they doing with it? So this is actually, if we understand the nature of our mind, this is how we stop hatred. And it's also how we stop attachment. It's actually how we get real freedom within our mind. So Lama Yeshe used to make us say, my Buddha potential is as good as the Buddha's. So we're going to say it too. My Buddha potential is as good as the Buddha's. And we'll do it again, and you onliners too, you've got to say it out loud, loud and proud. My Buddha potential is as good as the Buddha's. How about that? It's a fantastic mantra, isn't it? So clarity and non-duality. This is from Lama Yeshe, Introduction to Tantra. By contemplating our stream of consciousness in meditation, we can be led naturally to this spacious experience of non-duality. As we observe our thoughts carefully, we will notice that they arise, abide, and disappear themselves. There is no need to expel thoughts from our mind forcefully. Just as each thought arises from the clear nature of our mind, so too does it naturally dissolve back into this clear nature. When thoughts eventually dissolve in this way, we should keep our mind concentrated on the resulting clarity as undistractedly as we can. So this is why we need to actually practice meditation, that we can keep our mind still and focused. Like, that's building our technology. If we were fledgling scientists, we might try and build a radio or a telescope or whatever it is. We need to have some tools. So to be able to really understand the nature of our mind, we need the tools. And number one, the tool that we need is concentration. To be able to go, I'm going to contemplate this now, and to be able to do so without going, oh, shiny thing. Or being just distracted by what comes in through the senses, distracted by restlessness. So I became quite familiar with this just through going through the creative process. When I was making circus costumes, I'd noticed this whole trajectory where I would get incredibly agitated. I'd be procrastinating first, of course. So that's all the egotism and everything comes up, and the fear of failure and all of that kind of stuff. Very coarse minds, habit patterns and things. And then I'd start really figuring out what I was going to make. And I'd get some really good ideas and things would be coming together, and I'd just get really agitated. I'd like ads in my pants. I could not sit still. Anything to distract me. And so that's this, you know, that as the mind becomes inspired, it just goes out of control. It's like a drunk driver. So I had to learn how to talk to the hand, like put that aside and just focus the mind and talk myself down. And so becoming aware of how it's this kind of emotional surge that comes up, and we're so identified with our emotions, we think they're us. There's no way that we're going, that is this emotion of restlessness arising in the clear spaciousness of my mind. Anyway, because this would happen again and again, and because I was like pushing my deadlines, I had to learn to work with this agitation, because I had to get the thing done, and the only way I could get it done by morning was if I could concentrate. So then I became aware that this awareness of my mind, while everything else is raging, the emotions are raging, the concentration's going backwards and forwards, but there's this stability. There's the mind just continues. And so then, because I just wanted to get the thing done, I didn't give all of the worries and the agitation any oxygen, just left them in the periphery. So again, you don't have to make them disappear. You just leave them be. They're not the main point. And so then I got to a stage where I could focus my mind, and I could keep going with the creative process, and I could do the whole thing without any sleep, and everything was fine until someone came in the morning, and then everything would fall down, the whole stack of cards, boom, 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 and then I'd lose my concentration, I'd be tired and cranky and everything. But actually, in a way, it was like I had to be that tired to release all of those distractions till there was just the one thing to focus on. I think with Buddhist meditation, there are many far better ways to learn how to focus and concentrate your mind than my haphazard way. But I can definitely say from experience, it's possible to do. And the main impetus that we have is if we recognize this is our nature, Buddha nature, then it's worth it. It's worth putting in all that effort to have this incredible goal to go towards and why to benefit all sentient beings. So Lama Yeshe says, the conclusion then is that we all have the capacity to move from the confused, polluted state of ego conflict to the natural, clean, clear state of pure consciousness itself. We should never think that our mind has somehow become irreversibly contaminated. That's impossible. If we can train ourselves to identify and enter into the natural, unaffected state of our consciousness, we will eventually experience the freedom of blissful, non-dual awareness. So, nature of mind. A person imputed upon body and mind. The body and mind are different in nature, but they're connected. And we've outlined the various levels of mind, the fundamental, you know, the differences like being an onion, all the different layers and so on. The nature of the mind, merely clear and lucid. And because of this, all beings have the potential for Buddhahood. So it might be kind of strange to think of this as a scientific basis, but this is mind science. It's not based on belief. It's based on really a fine investigation of our nature, of our experience. And the real practical takeaway, when we're struggling, remember the clear sky above the clouds. That's the thing. No matter what is arising in the mind and our experience, when we're struggling, remember all of that is arising in that clean, clear nature. That's why we can even experience it. So for the coming week, try and identify mind like the sky and the clouds are not me. You are not your afflictions. You are not the clouds. And next week, we're going to look at, if we have this continuum of mind, where to next? What determines our next rebirth? It's about karma. Why do things happen to us? What do we carry along with us in our mind stream? And also, how can we purify negative karma? How can we make sure that we don't have to have all those suffering experiences? How do we clean that mirror? How do we get the dirt off the mirror-like mind? So let's dedicate. Take a moment to recognize that this whole class happened, your experience in that clean, clear nature. And we set that experience off in a really positive direction at the beginning with an altruistic intention. And so we can continue to set this in a positive direction. May we really understand our nature and bring all of our nascent qualities and potential to fruition. And may we be able to do it in this very lifetime, clarify our mind and achieve our natural kind of birthright of Buddhahood, so that we can help all the other sentient beings who are also equally ignorant of their potential and their nature and thus suffer so much. So dedicate all of your efforts of understanding to be able to bring about lasting peace and happiness for all beings. Okay. Thanks, everybody. Have a great rest of the week.